Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Since 1936, BC Fruit Trees has helped to promote British Columbia's amazing apples, pears, cherries, apricots, peaches, prune plums, and nectarines. Over 230 local grower families used the BC Tree Fruits Cooperative as part of a larger community to pack and market their fruit. Each person within the cooperative is a part of the bigger picture and played an important role in providing people with the fruits that they loved. But on July 26, BC Fruit Trees Co-op released a statement to their members and growers. BC Tree Fruits Cooperative will not be receiving fruit beginning today, Friday, July 26, 2024. We recommend that you immediately search for another alternative to market your fruit for the balance of the 2024 season. On July 25th, the Board of Directors determined that due to extremely low estimated fruit volumes and difficult market conditions, the cooperative would not be able to effectively operate the business and provide pool returns to growers. BC Tree Fruits Cooperative and all its subsidiaries are taking steps to obtain court direction and assistance to properly wind down the cooperative to maximize recovery for all stakeholders. As the logistics of a cooperative wind down are new to everyone, we ask for your patience as we navigate through the process. BC Tree Fruits Cooperative operates within the BC Cooperative Association Act and are therefore required to ensure that the act is followed. Signed, Rob Stewart, Chair, Board of Directors of BC Tree Fruits Cooperative, and Doug Pankew, Interim CEO and CFO of the BC Tree Fruits Cooperative. I requested an interview or a comment from BC Tree Fruits, but they were not granting interviews or sharing information beyond what was said in the press release at this time. But yet, the question still remains on how this will affect people who rely on delicious fruit stands to get those seasonal fruits that only come typically in the summertime to our tables. And more directly, the growers who rely on this very important part of their business of packaging and marketing their fruits will be affected starting this season. I have not spoken to a grower yet, but I am speaking to the owner of Guthrie's Fresh Fruits, Jessica Rampling, about how this affects her end of the business starting today.
My name is Jessica Rampling, and I am the owner and operator of Guthrie's Fresh Fruit, which is just a little fruit truck in the northwest of BC. So I service Terrace and Prince Rupert and Kitimat, as well as some like outlying villages that are even more remote than that.
Okay. Just hoping that you could tell me how the recent press release from BC Tree Fruits that they're ceasing operations, I guess if you could give me a little bit of info on how that affects your business and then also just the industry as a whole.
Yeah, it's troublesome because it's been operating for such a long time. And so the impacts that it will have on me directly are small, but how I interact with it directly is that I have a farmer who I get my supplies from consistently all the way through the season. And I've had him for a really long time, but whenever I call him and he doesn't have exactly what I want, he'll go and buy it from the Tree Fruit Co-op. And then so it really doesn't interrupt his service to me. And then on the flip side of that, if he ever has too much and he hasn't sold everything directly to his customers, he can take that excess and take it to the Tree Fruit Co-op and get rid of it. So it basically cuts out waste from the supply and demand, and it allows like small-scale farmers to be able to control their inventory, which is really critical in the food industry because it's all perishable. Farming is inconsistent, and you might have more or less on any given week or year.
With the loss of, especially like it's an 88-year-old cooperative, with the loss of something that has that community-mindedness behind it, are there many fruit packaging and marketing companies like this, or is this kind of the last vestige of something that will be replaced by maybe a larger company?
Yeah, that's certainly a fear. That was my first knee-jerk fear, was that, you know, that with, in the absence of this body, that a lot of this stuff will get swept up by major corporations and oligarchs. Example, like to the first part of your question, some farmers will have their own little makeshift packing lines that are in their farms. It's going to require a quite of an expensive cooler. It's going to require as many as 10 staff to run this packing line to take their fruit from just picked in the orchard to packed and cleaned and shipped off to a customer. And that just takes a lot of capital to have, like, to have that kind of investment. And the co-op is a way to primarily, I think, it's capital sharing so that not every single farmer has to have their own infrastructure to pull something like that off. And then they also don't have the kind of marketing budget which is required to get their whole, they're probably working 80 hours a week farming. They don't have the time or the resources to then be marketers of their fruit. And so, you know, this is a way to share resources.
As I mentioned to you before we were recording as well, is that they're not giving interviews right now. So the press release has been released and it does sound like they are just trying to basically maximize as much return to the members of this cooperative, farmers that have been relying on them for a long time as well. Is it taking effect right now? Are you feeling the effects of it this season, or will you be able to fill out the rest of this season?
This season has been just chaos from the get-go. That my first thought when I read the statement that they were shutting down was like, I was staggered that it was immediate. It was in a couple of weeks. I have no idea what's happening internally, but this year has been just crazy. Where before I have about 4 suppliers that I've used since the beginning. I make 4 phone calls a week. They fill my orders. They come up reliably and I can count on their quality. Whereas this year it's been, I probably have ordered from 8 or 9 different places, scrambling to get 30 boxes if they can get them. Whereas before I would just order 150 boxes and that would be no problems, and quality's inconsistent. It's coming from all over the place. We don't know how long ago it's been packed. That's been since the beginning of this year. It's been a big scramble. The closure of this co-op, I think, is going to be really felt by the farmers. You know, how it trickles down to me way up here in the north is, that's unknown. I don't know.
Is there anything else that I didn't ask that is important to include in this conversation now?
Oh, yeah. Politically, I think people should really be prioritizing, like, food security as, like, from an organized perspective of our government. Planting a garden is awesome, and I absolutely advocate for it, but that's not going to bridge the gap between what the entire province eats now and 10 years from now. So it's really critical that we push every level of government to have food security as a concern. And I do these deliveries to some of the bands up here, Kitsikukla, and sometimes to Haida Gwaii, and their governments are literally buying food and distributing it for their communities. Like, they are literally putting a case of fruit into every household. And I think that there's a lesson to be learned there, that it should be part of the portfolio of our governments. Just to bear that in mind when you're grilling your local politician, as everybody spends their time doing, I'm sure. But like, just that this is coming. Like, the dangers to our food security they're already here, and there's more to come.
This is Bird Note. While Sierra Taliaferro was working as a naturalist in Broward County, Florida, the Broward County Library approached her with the unique opportunity to enhance the public's knowledge about the basics of birding. This was in 2021, 1 year deep into the COVID-19 pandemic. There was already a visible interest in birding as a safe outdoor activity.
Once people start feeling more comfortable with going outside, they realize that there's this awesome activity called bird watching and they want to learn more about it.
Sierra and others came up with the idea of putting together backpacks full of birding gear that people could check out from the library, including a field guide to Florida birds and binoculars.
Depending on if it's an adult or if it's a kid, they'll have the appropriate binoculars in there. So we were super involved, super invested, because we wanted to make sure that people were going to get the necessary things that they needed to get started.
Sierra gave a webinar crash course that focused on how to use the supplies and empowered people to birdwatch wherever they live.
You just need to have an open mind, an open heart, and open ears, honestly. I often say, like, birding is so unconventional. You can literally bird outside your window. You can bird in the parking lot of the grocery store because there's birds all around us.
And the project made sure that people could access these backpacks wherever they were.
We were very intentional about where we were going to distribute those backpacks. Broward County is very large, so we partnered up with 10 local Broward County libraries across the county.
And the birding backpacks were a hit.
Where even till this day that they're still taking out backpacks, that was a huge success for us.
To learn more about the Broward County Library birding backpacks, visit birdnote.org. I'm Dara Miles Wilson.
Are you a First Nations, Métis, or Inuit student? Not convinced university, college, or vocational trade school is possible? Or wondering what you should do after high school? Inspire can help you and your friends. Register for Inspire's free Indigenous mentorship program, Rivers to Success. Joining Rivers to Success gets you access to great information, great prizes, and exciting content. Discover careers and post-secondary paths geared towards Indigenous students across Turtle Island, just like you. Register online today at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca. Prizes, information, and fun are waiting.
The Crab Park Encampment on the shores of Burrard Inlet, adjacent to Vancouver's downtown and the Port of Vancouver, has been in place for more than 2.5 years. When the homeless camp in East Vancouver's Strathcona Park was forcibly closed down by the city and the province in the spring of 2021, the promise was that homes would be found for all the evicted residents. Even at the time, advocates like Fiona York knew that this was a false promise. While many found homes, for many others, the offered housing did not meet their needs, was too restrictive, did not allow them freedom and freedom or dignity, or was simply short-term and not a long-term solution. Many homeless folks did not want to go to the newly offered housing. The new camp at Crab Park sprung up even as the camp at Strathcona Park was being dismantled. It wasn't long before authorities tried to close down this camp as well. A legal challenge to the eviction was mounted in 2022, and in an unexpected victory, an injunction was granted 2 years ago, and the Crab Park encampment became the first legally sanctioned encampment in Canada. Since then, an uneasy relationship has existed between the camp community and the Vancouver Parks Board. Just a few weeks ago, the Parks Board blocked an effort to set up tiny homes as an improvement over the current tents at the camp. Clint Brandon is a camp resident and has been a leader and advocate for the camp community. I spoke with him at the Crab Park encampment just before Christmas. You'll hear some of the sounds of the area in the background, helicopters, horns, and traffic.
Okay. May you start out by introducing yourself?
I'm Clint Brandon.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So tell me a bit about the camp here. We're at Crab Park.
Yep.
And how long has the camp been here?
Well, the camp originally now has been legal for, I believe it's 2.5, 3 years now. We've got the court order to be here now. Up before that, though, it was another 2 years that we sat here struggling and fighting up on the hill here. And it's been a hard battle, right? Like, it's still kind of overwhelming some days that we even got the victory, because it's the first legal encampment that's out there, right? And it's created a snowball effect, like a domino effect all the way around the world, right, where people are starting to fight for their rights, and you know, hopefully the idea here is like, there's still a lot of work to be done, but the idea is to show that you know, just because people are homeless doesn't mean that they're useless and they're worthless, and you know, we all have problems in life and we all have things that we got to struggle against, but you know, everybody's got something to give, right? And there's a lot of skilled people here that have something to give, and we want to show the world that we can take care of ourselves. We don't need to you know, like, we just hand up, not a handout, right? Like, this is what we're kind of looking for. Yeah. So, and so far, it's just everyday small victories, right?
So what difference did it make when you got that court order and the camp became legal as opposed to when it was here as an illegal camp?
A lot of people came together even more so than when we were fighting originally, right? Like, mm-hmm. There's now inside the camp, you know, it's like, I mean, I know there's lots of rumors that fly around about these places, and I'm not necessarily saying that they're always incorrect, but like, we got a different kind of camp here where even if there's personal issues with each other, it doesn't come down to fighting and beating people up and assaulting people. And when it comes to standing up for the camp, we all band together always to stick to the camp first, right, and take care of each other. New people come in and they need something, we always supply it, right? Everybody's welcome here. Anybody that needs a hand up or anything we can give is welcome to anybody, right? And we got it, I gotta be honest, we got it pretty good here, right? We've got regular food all the time, and we've got, you know, we got a warming tent if anybody's cold and just needs to warm up. It's pretty decent for an outdoor shelter camp, right?
That's good. What kind of community exists here?
Like I said, it started out as when we were on the hill, it was a little bit more of your average kind of tent city that was. You know, I mean, you still got your standard problems like any homeless, you know, place has, right? You got addiction issues and things like that. But we try to set some guidelines and rules here with you know, just basic human respect, right? And no stealing, no lying. You know, we try to deal with our own problems, but at the same time, we try to act a little bit a step above the average,
right.
You know, homeless individual, and whether we do or not, who knows? But we try, right?
So, is there sort of a like a committee or some sort of governments that?
Yeah,
help you to make decisions?
We usually do, for the most part, we work on a seniority system, right? Whoever's been here the longest and basically has taken that leadership role on. Like, we don't necessarily vote anybody in, but we kind of do as well, I guess. It's kind of right in between there, right? We don't have any official voting system, but I've been here since day one. I'm part of the original 20. My wife's part of the original 20. I think we have two other people that are still here that are part of the original 20 members that started this like 4.5 years ago. But, and then we have some other senior members that have been here, you know, 2-3 years as well. And basically seniority is the number one thing, because then, you know, seniority relates to experience, right?
Yeah.
So that's the biggest thing we do.
Do you have regular meetings? Or?
We do. We were having weekly meetings, but now we've reduced them to, I think, we're going monthly, basically, when we need them, right?
Yeah.
Because the weekly meetings were just to the point where a lot of people were talking about a lot of stuff, but nothing was getting accomplished. So we decided that, you know, maybe it's best if we reduce the amount of time meeting and a little bit more time doing, right? So, and we've been working out, in my opinion, right? Like, when things start to build up, then we have another meeting and reorganize and restructure and start again, usually once, twice a month.
Okay. So what are the kind of issues that come up that might make you feel you need a meeting to talk about things?
Fire safety, spacing between the tents, right, because that's a big fire issue. Something we got going with the park board right now, because obviously this is a public park space, right, and it wasn't obviously designated to support a small community, right, it was designed for public usage. And so you got issues with the fire department and all that, especially with the fire department and fire codes, right? Like, everything we need to survive is basically considered a fire restriction, right? So there's an argument there. At the same time, you know, a lot of these tents and what they do allow us to use are more flammable than the stuff that is actually considered a restriction, right? Like, I know these tents will go up a lot quicker than something made out of wood, right? But we're not allowed to have pallets and things like that, right? But, you know, that's where the heads clash a little bit. And we're trying to meet with the park board and trying to come to a middle ground, right, which is... I'm hoping over the last couple of weeks we've actually broken through and gotten some better communication on the go, right? Because I just attended a meeting a couple of days ago, and it seems like they're a little more open-minded to working something out. We had an incident about a week ago up on the hill here, because that's technically our borderline there, right? We're not supposed to come outside that borderline. This remains park space. And some of the encampments started coming up the hill a little bit, and the rangers came in and started tearing down the tents. This is the same thing they used to do to us a few years ago. They started like physically tearing down the tents with people inside them and throwing their stuff away. And, you know, it might look like garbage or trash to other people, but to some of us, it's the only thing we have, right? And, you know, the winter's coming and things like that. And some of those people, there's some senior citizens out there. They're 60, 70 years old, right? Mm-hmm. And now we don't know where they are, and we don't know if they're okay. We don't even know if they're alive right now, right? And the rangers throw their stuff in the back of the truck, and they claim it's going to storage. But it doesn't go to storage. It's in the garbage. We've never been able to reclaim any of it, right? And that's heartbreaking. That's overwhelming to see that, right? We try to offer someone a safe place to be, and then an arm of the government comes in and steps on us like we're... You know, that was, but on both sides, it turned into a bit of a physical altercation, the first one ever, and it was, the police had to be called for that, and it was kind of embarrassing on both parts, right?
Right.
So since then, both the parks board and our side has been a little bit more, I think, open to communication, right? Because I don't want to see that, and I know no one in our encampment wants to see that, like...
So you had some talks and sort of worked out some new rules?
As soon as that happened, right, that very day, I said, man, you guys can't be doing this. One of the members of our camp, I won't mention names, but one of the members of our camp got everybody riled up that day because when the rangers showed up. And I understand why they get riled up, and I totally get the point, and I've been there, but we're at a point now where that kind of thing just can't happen. We're not going to get anywhere with that, right? We're beyond that point, right? Like, people are listening to us and they're supporting us in a lot of ways, right? I mean, obviously we get some people who don't support us, but we actually have a lot of community support here, and so, yeah, stuff like that doesn't look good for us or anybody, right? So
how involved is the city and the parks board and the fire department and the police in coming down here and interacting with you? Because I know when the camp was first set up, there was a lot of that. You know, they came in, I think they took the camp down a couple times, and... You know, and then you guys came back and set up again, and eventually you sort of came to an agreement.
Well, what happened is they decided they were going to get they pulled an injunction on us, and they said, okay, we're pulling an injunction on us, so, you know, the police are going to come down with their riot squad and basically tell us. And that's a violent way to get removed from anywhere, right? Yeah. That would suck. So my wife jumped out of bed that morning, all upset, and she ran out of the tent, and she says, you know what, you guys are pulling an injunction on us? She said, fine, I'm countersuing. and that got the ball rolling, and here we are, right? As soon as that happened, we had a four-person legal team that stepped up to the plate, and they supported us pro bono, and it was amazing. We owe them everything. And it was the injunction got stopped. We beat that, and that slowed the park board down right away, and they realized that what we were doing was serious, and it wasn't, mm-hmm. we weren't just playing around. This is life and death. This is our lives, right? And there's a lot of people here that are trying to make changes and are trying to get somewhere, right? And so, I mean, we don't want the whole park, but we want to keep it clean. We don't want to, you know, we just need somewhere safe for us to go, right? And that's what we like to believe this place is, right? That's the one thing is, you know, we won't let other people come down here. And there was one issue that happened, an incident, and that was a tragic incident that happened, but it wasn't a member of our park. It was a member of someone up on the street that came down here and caused a bunch of assaults on a bunch of people. And that was, and ever since that day, we've gotten a bit of a reputation down here where, again, there's no violence down here. We don't tolerate violence down here, right? It was just a tragic day that came that day. It was actually really disturbing. Yeah, like this is a safe community, right? We all support each other, stand up for each other. We're like a bit of a family, right? A lot of us don't have family, so this is it, right?
How important is that community to you? Because I mean, obviously, this is going to be
this is huge.
A better environment than, you know, sleeping in a doorway or isolated,
and
on your own in a park.
And it's offered a lot of opportunities. I mean, even this right now, like this type of interaction, I wouldn't be able to do a few years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm able to even interact better socially with people, right? Like,
yep.
And so, even for me, it's my whole life right now. It's right. And fighting for the other people and the other homeless people that are out there. It's just, it kind of feels like, whether I have a choice or not, it's a role that I've, me and my wife kind of took on kind of suddenly, and now we're. Yeah, we can't walk away from it now, right?
Like it's, how many people are living in the camp right now?
Winter time, it always you think it would get bigger, but actually gets a little bit smaller during the winter because there's people that show up in the summer that think it's some kind of resort or something. But so we're down to, I think we got about 80, 90 tents up. I think we only got a population of about 45, 50 at the moment.
Right.
Some are in and out, kind of in between housing or like temporary housing or an SRO, and they're just kind of making adjustments. And then at the same time, we have always people coming in and out. You get some people to come, you know, for a week or a few days and things like that, and they're getting housing or they have something else on the go. We do have some people that come in and just stay for a little while. They just moved here or something, and they're getting in and something, you know, so we have that as well, right? So, but I think right now we have about, last count, I think we have 45 actual full-time tenants right now.
Okay. And what sort of supports are in place in the camp as an organized and now legal camp?
We got tons of kitchens that donate food to us every day. We got larger grocery stores that donate us food. We got smaller jobs on the go, right? We got an OPS program, overdose prevention program, which is one of our donations right now. I think that's one of our lunch donations. Yep. These are another. They've been donating to us for 2 years now.
Yeah.
We have a couple GoFundMes up that we're trying to get a solar power system up and stay away from the fossil fuels. Right now we have to use generators, but those we want to get away from, and those aren't they're not really financially viable, right? Like, I'm the mechanic, but I work on them all. I don't mind doing that,
yeah.
But. Just the cost for at this more donations that we got asked for. So we're trying to get a solar system actually in place, and we got a GoFundMe up for that, and then we're trying to work with the park board to see if we can get some, you know, alternative funding for that, and then whatever funding we can come up with as well, right? Like, I go to the temp service and work as much as I can, and then we got some small jobs around the camp that people get paid for. Like, we got a cooking job, and we got a clean up crew and things like that all get paid small amounts. That all comes from donations though too, right? And so we got a limited budget, but everybody, you know, there's small employment jobs that get, which is, we're trying to work on some more employment for everybody, right? Try to get some actual funding to come in, and we're working on a proposal now where, you know, a little bit of government funding.